people listening, I'm sitting here. I have Steph and Cal, Steph Smith, Cal, Calvin Rosser, newly married. So congratulations. Did the last names change at all in there anywhere? Or is it still
no.
Steph Smith, Calvin Rosser?
Okay. Still the same names. We okay. must be the first married couple you've had on, though.
This, yes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think you're the first duo in any sense that we've had on. Like, we typically don't even do, we don't even really do interviews that much. But yes, so married, hosts of the Shit You Don't Learn in School podcast, also very good friends of mine. We go back a long ways into startup land. So it's great to have you guys on. I really just wanted to sit down and talk today about this whole crazy world of AI content gen and what you're seeing out there. So welcome in.
Thanks. Excited we're the first couple you've had. Let's see how this goes. Let's see if the marriage lasts the podcast.
Well, the thing
so
going
first
for us
question,
is...
who's messier? Who leaves the dishes out? Yeah, no. What were you saying, Cal?
I was saying the thing we have going for us is if we're the only couple, that means it's the best episode with a couple showing up. So that's a boon.
It's also, I just realized this morning, it's like sort of a tables have turned thing because I was one of the first guests on... Shit, I think maybe the first guest? No. First
maybe.
Guest on Shit You Don't Learn in School?
One of the few also. I think we've maybe had three max.
I ruined it for everyone.
No.
So now the tables have turned. You guys are on our show. And, I think a lot of people listening to this will know both of you just from your creator backgrounds. So I don't, maybe we won't spend too much time
let's
on
skip
that.
It.
But like, yeah, let's skip it. Let's just dive straight into the AI stuff. So one of the rules we had for the show was like no prep. And what I meant by that was we're all so immersed in this. Like we already have opinions. We're already seeing a lot of it. I don't think we need to bring like professional level data to the table. I just want to pick your guys' brains and like hear how you're thinking about stuff. The way I framed this was, I think there are two really popular conversations going on out there about AI gen or AI. We'll just say AI for short, but it's like AI generated content, right? The two really popular conversations are like, this is either terrible for the creator economy because now like everyone's job is going to get replaced, or it's going to be a really helpful tool for humans, but humans are still necessary somewhere. I think those two points of view have been like discussed quite a bit recently. What I'm curious to hear from both of you is like, what do you think people are missing? What are people not talking about inside that conversation so far?
Okay. So, I mean, I think you're right that often when something as game-changing as this comes along, people have very binary takes. They're like, as you said, this is the end. Like, no one has a job anymore. Or like, this is just so overhyped. I think this one is somewhere in the middle. Although I've been very... I've been shocked in a way with some of the developments in ways that I haven't been in other kind of innovative industries in the last couple of years, where I have been like, wow, this can do things that I didn't think it would be able to do in the time span that AI has been worked on. So I think, there's a little bit of, oh my gosh, like what of my skills are still relevant here or will still be relevant in the next couple years. I think that's really more where I'm looking, where I have a sense of where it is today. And I think I've still got a job today and I'm not worried about it, but there is a sense of, wow, this is an exponential technology. And if this is, you know, if even if you compare where we are in 2022 to where AI was 5 years ago, I mean, if we use an example of generating faces 5 years ago, none of them looked realistic. And people thought, you know, you're always going to be able to tell if a picture of a person is generated by AI or if it's a real photo. And today we're at a place where you can't really tell. And so if you continue to advance that, not just in images, but like, as you said, written content, animations, movies, it's, I don't know. It's interesting to think about where that's going. I will say that one aspect that I think people might miss is the difference between innovation and adoption. And what I mean by that is, the tools are very impressive already, and they will only continue to get better, but it takes people to deploy the tools to really change our world. And if you look at many innovations throughout history, they existed for a long time before the masses adopted them. And one example that I've been sharing recently is the floppy disk, where I read this article in the NumLock newsletter recently, where basically Japan's Minister of Digital Affairs is literally making it his personal mission to eradicate the floppy disk in 2022 because it's still so prevalent there. And that's just an example of, like, yes, technology can exist, but sometimes humans take longer to actually implement it. And I'll kind of close this out by saying I shared my AI avatars on my Instagram, which was more towards like my group of friends that aren't deep on Twitter and in technology, and none of them cared. You know, like, all of our friends within technology who are working in the same kinds of companies were like, this is crazy, like the whole world is shifting, and no one batted an eye in my friends outside of this space. So I think that's just important to keep in mind, that again, an innovation can happen immediately or not immediately, but like on one day something can exist, but that does not mean that it permeates the rest of the world immediately as well.
That's such an interesting point. Hilarious about the floppy disks too. Like, I had no idea this was still being used anywhere. Cal, what do you think about this? What are like some of the conversations that are not taking place?
Well, I think on this one, I guess a general thought is that I think generative artificial intelligence is going to be in an over-promise, under-deliver phase for a while. So I think it's too hyped in the short term, aka like what it will do in the next 1 to 2 years. But I think it's probably under-hyped in terms of what it will do in 10 to 20 years. And I can't predict what that will be. But if it is an exponential technology, I think we can't really fathom the way in which this may integrate into creating or other parts of the world in a decade. But over the next 1 to 2 years, at least in playing around with these tools, I mean, they're cool, but I think there is a missing link of how do I make this essential to what I'm doing? So that's one piece of how I think about it. And then the second is, I think the argument about, oh, these things might take our jobs. I mean, it's probably true that low-level writing and other forms of creating will be supplanted by good generative artificial intelligence tools. But I think some people are missing the opportunity to 10x your output or to just become a more effective person by jumping on this train and figuring out how can I be the best person that knows how to use the latest tools and stack them, or to prompt the tools the best and to take advantage of this new skill set, which I think will be similar to like learning how to be a good internet marketer maybe 10 or 15 years ago. Had you picked up on that, there was so much easy money and opportunity that came out of that. And so I think this opens up that door too. And so I would focus less on, oh, my job's going to be replaced, and more, how can I partner with this machine to get a first mover advantage on this tech that likely integrates more widely than I think over the next 10 years?
That's a really interesting point as well. Steph, you're making me think about something here, which is like, okay, the speed of adoption for AI is sort of an interesting problem because it provides such an asymmetric benefit to the people who are potentially using it, like Cal just said. What do you guys, like, do you foresee any issues with the groups that are slow to adopt? Because like one thing you have me thinking about is, boy, it could really suck to be one of the last movers on something like this, because the other people are just going to be so, I don't think humans are generally good at thinking in exponential terms. And this, maybe I'm not fully understanding it. Maybe there's something I'm missing, but this really feels like a game changer in a way that I haven't felt it at very many points in my career. So I don't know. What do you guys think? Is there like going to be, if, what happens if we're the Japan of AI, you know?
Well, I think it's important to note that yes, AI, I believe, is extremely game changing, but I would frame it as a parallel to many other technologies that have already come to be in similar ways. So, you know, I think Steve Jobs famously called the computer the bicycle of the mind. And if you think about what a computer can do, or what a phone can do, or even access to internet can do for someone, as you're saying, it really is a differentiator in terms of the possibilities, the opportunities that people get access to. So yes, I think you're right that people understanding and being able to leverage AI will kind of sequester people into different buckets and their ability to participate. But I would say that a lot of this is pretty widely available, right? If you go to OpenAI's website, like it's, you don't need to know any code to run a prompt through DALL-E or GPT-3. Mm-hmm. Same goes for some of the newer tools that are being built off of GPT-3, right? Like Lex or Jasper. You don't need new skills to do this. And so, yes, I think there will be a differentiation between the people who choose to jump on board and the people who don't. But I actually think maybe this is more democratizing than prior innovations, because if you use the example of something like an iPhone or a phone, like that costs way more in, you know, to use another example, like access to internet. That is something where it's like people fundamentally had or didn't have. This is something where if someone's already operating online in this ecosystem, it really is, I think, a lower barrier to entry than maybe some of the prior innovations that have differentiated the masses.
That's a super interesting point. This is another thing that I'm kind of torn on about this too, because if you really look at the players who are involved, it's like, on the one hand, some people think the most productive thing you could do is learn, is go out and start looking at all these new tools and learning how to use the new tools. But really, I think, and this is sort of tied in with Cal's point, some of the most powerful functionality that really exists in these things is going to be tied in to the big players pretty soon. So Microsoft has, you know, what do they call it? It's like they have exclusive rights to certain models from OpenAI. So they're going to be tying some of those language models into like Word, right? So in terms of like writing for AI, do you really need to learn how to go out and use Jasper or Lex, or do you just like wait 18 months and it's right in Word? For image creation, you can imagine how Google image search will eventually incorporate this as well. Like very soon, to your point, Steph, I think a lot of the major players people are already using are going to be the hubs for a lot of the tools that we're seeing kind of proliferate right now. Like there'll be this explosion and then very quick condensation towards a few major players. And so I'm kind of torn on like, do you really need to know the entire landscape, or is this so much of a game changer that it ends up being concentrated in the hands of the big sort of players that are out there right now?
Well, what I think you might be speaking to, and I'd love to get Cal's perspective on this as well, is we've played around with several AI tools, especially in the text-to-text and text-to-image spaces, and a lot of them are very similar. And naturally, it's because a lot of them are built off of the same models. And so really what, you know, to use Lex as an example, they did not train their own AI model. They're building off of GPT-3 and they're adding their own UI. And so there's differentiation potentially there in the features that you add on top of the model. But what you are seeing, to give another example, in the text to image space of these avatar AIs, like, there's two people who I think were first movers. All their features are the same. And then there's a bunch of other people who are like, oh, this is all built on the same API, which is Astria. And so then, you know, everyone else is building the same things. And ultimately what we're seeing, at least for now, is that a lot of the products coming out are very, very similar. And so what I think you're getting at is ultimately what often wins in situations like that are the folks that have distribution. And so it might be the case where you're right that some of these larger companies who already have access to the masses might win. I mean, a parallel example is what Microsoft did with Teams, right? Slack was the first mover and kind of built out that ecosystem. And then Teams was like, we're just going to bundle this with everything, right? And ultimately, they're still very successful. But that's an example of where when you have the same feature set, distribution wins. So Cal, I'm interested to hear what you think about that, because you've played around with some tools that have a lot of similar features too.
Well, I think right now we're focusing on what companies may win, but I guess in the future we'll see is my answer to that. But I still think there's this fundamental new skill that I think is very much like Googling online, where you will have to figure out how to work with the AI to increase your output. And that's actually the skill that many people haven't developed. And even I, in playing with these tools, some of it's cool and interesting, but there's not like a daily way in which I work with the AI tools to improve my writing or to, I don't know, feel like I have an editor by my side when I'm doing certain articles. And so that to me is as these tools develop and you get Lex, you get Microsoft doing things, it doesn't really matter. It's more about how can you use these tools to leverage yourself. And just to give a different example, Zapier came out, I don't know how long ago, but that helps you automate tasks and, you know, connect different tools. And then you have like Gumroad for distribution of creative products. Those tools themselves, there's probably other forms of them, but the most interesting thing is how can you as a creator leverage those to do what you want to do faster and better and at a lower cost?
I actually think the example that Cal gave is really interesting for us, Ethan, because we worked on trends for so long and you're still there, but the act of being able to Google well, or to know what tools exist online, like SimilarWeb or Jungle Scout, or knowing how to look through Amazon reviews, like those are things that everyone in theory had access to. But it was a skill to master, right, for our trends analysts to understand what to look out for and what tools are at your disposal and how to use them well. And I think there will be a similar phenomena here of like, these tools will be accessible, but people will learn how to almost like refine that skill of using them. And then similar to Google, a lot of people know how, you know, they know physically how to type something into the Google search bar, but they also don't know all the little refinements or things that you can add to it. Like they truly don't know what they don't know about how extensive this tool can be.
Yeah, that's actually a super interesting point. This is something that we do talk about quite often. It's like, we don't have access to different data than anybody else at Trends. We just know how to use, well, maybe we have more awareness and we know how to use what's out there differently than most people do. Cal, yeah, I agree with you too, man. When I hear you talk about the way people are currently thinking about these tools versus how they may end up being used, it makes me think of something that I've been feeling the last couple of days as I start to work with more and more of them, which is that they're very novel, right? Like the first time you see images produced out of thin air, you're like, wow. And then that starts to wear off. And what I've been thinking about a lot recently is just the blinding speed at which I think the novelty of these will wear off, and that we'll have to kind of settle into that deeper mode of figuring out, okay, well, what's the real use for this every day? Because it's not enough to just be able to create pictures out of thin air. That's fun for the first couple of days that you're playing with it, but now it's got to find a place in like real day-to-day life.
Yeah. And just on the image front, let's take that as just a starting place. The way, it's not just that you can generate images that you otherwise wouldn't be able to get. It's how you use that. So if you are a Shopify store, instead of having to do a 3-day photo shoot where you hire expensive models and do editing on the photos for your products afterwards, whether it's for clothing or supplement products, you might be able to actually use AI to generate that without ever having to hire a model or an editor. And so if you can actually take that use case, you've then saved time and money and can go then distribute your product or allocate those resources in ways that make your business more successful. But that would be the actual skill that you want to learn how to use. And all of that requires that you still have a product that people want to buy, and you then just use these tools to do things better. Otherwise, the tools themselves, they're just kind of cool, shiny things that you can play with, and it's awesome. But what's the use of doing that? And just one question for you, since you're a writer, have you, in your time playing with these tools, actually ever use a sentence written by AI in your work?
No, actually, that's not true. But the only time I have is when I'm writing about sentences created by AI. So I've done one article about, you know, what it really is like to ask GPT-3 to create long form writing. And in that case, yes, I've used GPT-3 output. But no, I think the more simple answer to your question is like, no, I've not yet found the way to make this really tie into what I need every single day, because the actual problem that GPT-3 solves at this stage is not the hardest part of my job. You know, like what I need is things that can help with fact checking and research. And those are the real time consumers. Coming up with an outline or a first draft is not where I struggle.
So I think that would be a good bar, if I'm a writer and you do some writing as well, of how useful or game changing is this product really? If I also haven't used a single sentence from an AI generated tool to improve my writing. And so I think that will change at some point. But that to me is the litmus test for real value or actually a game changing thing. And right now it reminds me of the hype cycle around lots of different things where it's very cool, it's innovative, but it's yet to cross the chasm of this is really useful.
Totally.
I think another parallel is if you consider even separate from the machine, all of us have been in a situation where there's something that we don't want to do, but it's actually just easier for us to do it than to document and delegate it to someone else. And so if you were to use a VA as an example, there's only a very small selection of things that are straightforward enough that a VA can then go and do. And I think one interesting aspect of AI is that it is now doing more creative things than a VA typically would. But at the same time, I think what we're going to need to see are these tools becoming specialized for very specific things that we can say, okay, I need to create a sharing image for blog posts. And I need a tool that is not just generally creating images for me, but that I can harness for my brand. I can upload my brand colors. I can upload a bunch of training images from previous illustrations that I've, you know, used as sharing images. And it's really, really targeted at this one task that someone has to do. And so it makes it a no-brainer for them to say, okay, it's actually really easy for me to offload this one specific thing instead of having to like retrofit something that's super general towards the tasks that we really want to get done. So I think both of you have touched on something really important, which is like a lot of what currently is important because I do think these tools will evolve. A lot of what these tools currently do don't really solve our hardest problems. They just kind of awkwardly solve some of our easiest problems. And right now it's kind of like when you end up not delegating where you're like, it's actually just easier for me to do it the way I've always done it.
It's so interesting that you frame it that way, because what you're both making me think of is like, and this is one thing that I think has sort of been left out of the conversation a little bit too, more generally about AI, is past innovation. So it's pretty tempting, I think, when you see new stuff like this come out, to very quickly adopt, without even realizing it, the mindset that like everything that's been created so far is obvious, and then everything that's coming out now is game changing. And the reality, when you really dig into it, is like, no, we as a species have been through this dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of times before. Steph, what you just said made me think of how, what the adoption curve must have been like for other tools that we now consider time saving. So, you know, there's not a professional writer out there right now who's not using a computer in some form or another. But there was a time, and it wasn't that long ago, when like it was like pulling teeth to get people to try and write something on a word processor, because it was just so much easier for them to not have to like learn it and come up to speed. So there was a time when it was, you know, I think people would have said the same thing. Oh, it's just easier for me to do it this way. And ultimately, I'm not sure the tool changed that much over time. It certainly did. Like the user interface has got a lot nicer and more streamlined. There's something else too, though, about like shooing people into an ecosystem. And like once part of your life's on the laptop, well, now you're more likely to use it for these other things too. So I wonder if we're going to see something similar to that with AI.
Can I just share a quote quickly? I was just looking it up, but I think it speaks to this idea where, as I mentioned before, sometimes adoption just takes a while, and that's because inertia is just such a strong force. And, you know, it takes time for humans to change their perspective, and sometimes it doesn't happen. And it's this quote from Douglas Adams, and it's, anything that is in the world when you're born is normal and ordinary and just a natural part of the way the world works. So Tim was on this at the very beginning of our call. He was a baby. That baby will think all the things that we do with AI are just like completely normal, and like it's wild that there was a world that existed before these tools. And then the second part is, anything that's invented between when you're 15 and 35 is new and exciting and revolutionary, and you can probably get a career in it. And since I think all three of us are on the later end of that 15 to 35, I think that's why, you know, we all have our own, you know, we're independent thinkers, but at the same time, we are framed within this, like, this is cool and we're young enough to understand it, but we're also like, we're not Gen Z, so we're a little skeptical about parts of this. And then the final part is, anything invented after you're 35 is against the natural order of things, which is obviously, you know, this is generalized, but it's true. Like you ask your parents and they're like, no, like this shouldn't exist this way. And like, when I grew up, we all went and worked out and we, you know, we like collected our own wood. And it's like, for us, that just sounds ridiculous. But for our kids, a lot of the things that we do today will also sound ridiculous and dated. And I think it's important to remember like how our age and our experience frames how we interpret some of these new technologies.
That's so interesting. I'm sitting over here laughing because I feel that so hard. Like, the, and I'm coming up on that over 35 thing. It's still a couple of years out, but I guess I won't have to deal with many more innovations.
Well, Cal and I always make fun of you because in addition to you being on the later end of that spectrum, we always joke that you are like a 60-year-old at heart, or like you should have been born in the 1800s.
Oh, that would have been great.
I think one other thing with these tools is it's easy to get excited about them, but I think a lot of people will make the mistake of using the tools early on as a substitute for actually doing the work. So it's pretty easy with AI right now to generate pretty low level, mediocre blog posts, but that's not really going to do anything that useful for you. And if you wanted to say, be an actually high quality writer, you actually got to do the work and then figure out how to use the tools to leverage what you're currently doing or to improve it. And just as an example, Steph, I think you interviewed him, but Neal Stephenson, doesn't he still handwrite his books?
He does. So if people aren't familiar, Neal Stephenson is the author of Snow Crash, but he's also just been extremely prolific and written, I think, probably over a dozen books by now, many of which are successful. And he's always asked about how he manages to be prolific. And what he says is he handwrites his work, partially because I think he feels like it's just, it allows him to focus more and to get like concrete thought. But then he just does a couple pages a day of handwriting, but you can imagine if you compound that over many, many years, you end up with a lot of books. But anyway, yes, I'll turn it back to you, Cal, but he does still handwrite all of his work.
Yeah. So I find that interesting because as he was learning to be a writer, maybe that was the only tool available. And then all these other things came about. And yet he still uses that same process to be one of the best writers out there. And I even think about my own experience. I grew up with a computer, so I use that to write. But at the same time, I see how the computer, while it makes my writing more efficient and editing it more efficient as well, it also makes me more sloppy. It's easier and cheaper for me to type a bunch of nonsense as versus if I sat down with a blank page and a pen in my hand, I would be a bit more meticulous with how I use my words. And so I think these tools can do the same thing for people where they make certain things easier, but they make you too lazy or not willing to do the hard work of actually piecing together words in a way that really resonate with other people. And I don't think there's a substitute for learning that. You could do it in lots of different ways, but that would be my worry for new entrants who get too excited about these things and leverage them for everything. They're always going to be pretty average at things if that's the case.
I totally agree. This is one of the areas in which I think I've had my mind changed the most over the last couple of weeks. I mean, as you mentioned, I'm a bit of a late adopter when it comes to technology. And I think when I first started really getting into this AI stuff, my initial take was that it's cool, but it will never be a full replacement for human beings. That I think actually is changing. My opinion on that is it will eventually be able to do pretty much everything that your standard knowledge worker can do. I mean, but the thing that I keep coming back to is there are certain tasks that I think I'll always want to keep a hand in somehow because I like what they do for me. In my mind, you know, so for me, writing is a big one like that. It doesn't matter how easy it gets to write things, you know, using Jasper or whatever. Maybe some part of that enters my workflow down the line, but I really value the hard parts of writing in the way that somebody who's like a professional athlete probably values exercise, you know, like it's, they know all the upsides that brings them. And I'm never going to be willing to give that up completely. I don't want to. I have no desire to let go of that in every way. And just the last thing I would say is I feel like our generation has seen this play out, the risks of this play out in other areas. So like when Google first started coming out, one of the things people said was, oh, it's really important now to learn how, like learning how to look up information is more important than learning how to memorize it. That was the big thing everybody talked about. And then there were certain writers who started saying, well, actually, you know, now people are, their ability to memorize things or their ability to recall is degenerating. And for a long time, I didn't really care about that either. I said, well, who cares? But I feel like I'm getting to a point now where I feel it. I actually feel like my memory is not as good as it used to be. And it's making me actively want to push back against some of the just the easiness of like everything that we engage in day to day. So I feel like I've seen a version of this play out once before with access to information. And I don't think it's going to be as hard for me to resist the pull of AI in all the same ways because I've been through it once. But I agree with you, man, that like anybody who's going to be raised on this, I really question what their experience is going to be like if they never have life without it. I see you. Okay.
I agree and I disagree. Well, I agree with you that I sometimes have similar instincts of like, oh, it's bad that like I don't think the same way as I did before, or I can't do certain things that came so naturally to me before. But I do think some of these things are inevitable. Just to use the example of just the way work has evolved over the years. So you know, back in the day, we were hunters and gatherers, and there were certainly people who were like, oh, we, you know, the people who are moving into knowledge work, like, can't believe that they're doing this. Like, they don't have the same muscles as before. They can't fend for themselves. They can't fight. And sure, maybe some people still think that. But then the people who grew up in our generation are like, oh, knowledge work is so wonderful. We have the ability to then use our other assets and in other ways. We have more leverage over what we can accomplish. And then I think similarly, it reminds me of something I saw where this whole conversation around remote work is happening, where a bunch of people are pushing back in that same way of like, oh my gosh, are you so lazy? You can't even make it into the office. I think Seth Godin recently like clamped down on remote work and said something along those lines of like, you know, I can't believe people, you know, don't go into the office. Like, what do we live for anymore? But then for people who grew up in the generation where remote work, again, like, it opened our minds. It allowed us to do more things. I think there's just a flip side to everything. And I think naturally, again, inertia is a really strong force where depending on where you encounter something and then your historical frame can push you to be like, this isn't right, you know, or like, I don't like the direction this is moving. And there's merit to that. But I also think the same way that, you know, for us, it sounds crazy that like you won't be able to memorize these facts. I think maybe our children's generation is going to say it's actually really crazy that you spent 5 years of, you know, your education memorizing random years and facts about history, right? Like instead, maybe they could spend time still learning history, but not focusing on the facts and figures and understanding the psychology or the depth, the fights, the, you know what I mean? The more like human side of things. And so I don't know, I guess I'm just pushing back in the sense that like, it is true that this technology is fundamentally changing the way we all operate. But I would just, I kind of like check myself every time I start to think that as being a bad thing, because I think it is actually, whether it's bad or good, it's kind of one of those inevitable things.
Well, one thing that's interesting about that, that you make me think of, is that these technologies, they never evolve in a vacuum. So they always come around along with other things. And I see that right now with AI. And I think it's kind of poetic, maybe, that the ability to copy things in a way that humans have never seen before comes around at the same time as blockchain and its ability to verify things in the way that humans have never really seen before. And so there does seem to be sort of a balancing force on innovation, whether people do it on purpose or not. So I grant you that. I think it would be a mistake to say that like this technology exists and there's only one possible outcome. There's going to be a lot of forces at play here. But I do think that like one thing that I've observed just studying history is the cyclical nature of it and how much time we waste because we kind of cast off old things that were very effective in the name of innovation, and then eventually come back to them and be like, oh, this was actually a really great way to do things. And I would have to think about a good example of what that is, but I have seen it, and I don't know. Maybe that's just the curmudgeon side of me seeing it play out again with things like being able to remember things. You know, like, hey, did you know that you used to be able to just recall stuff?
Like you didn't know a phone. Cal makes fun of me all the time because we'll literally be in a place where your physical 5 senses could tell you the information that you need. And my instinct is to reach for my phone. I'll literally be in front of a place and I'll take out my phone and I'll be like, I wonder if it's open. And he's like, walk 5 steps to see if the door is open. So I hear you. And I do think one, I guess, framework that I liked recently was from Balaji's book, The Network State. And I can't remember the exact examples he gave, but he uses this like helical theory of history, which means that if you think about a helix, sometimes it feels like we're just going in circles. And in many ways we are. And as you said, sometimes we like leave behind things that feel like we're really positive. But he says with a helix, you also, it's like you're going in circles, but you're slowly iterating in one direction, if that makes sense, hopefully a positive direction. And I think that is maybe a good representation of how I feel like innovation happens.
That is interesting. Cal, I saw you laughing there a second ago.
Oh, I just laugh from time to time. I was just thinking that a lot of technology, so I try to adopt things and keep up with them, but at the same time, there's almost always a cost to technologies that promise to do things faster or more efficiently. Like in the case that Steph is talking about, let's just say I don't know how to orient myself on a map because I have Google Maps and I'm just able to plug that in and I assume the internet's always going to work. And that really is only a problem if the internet goes down and I need to go navigate in the wild, which is some edge case that I'm willing to, you know, not prepare for, if you will. But at the same time, there's this process of getting good at anything. It's like the basic process of mastery. And if you outsource some of the pieces of that, whether it's having Lex write a really good sentence or something, and then you share that with others, and maybe you could be perceived as a good writer, but you never learned how to do that yourself. And that actually may be okay. Mm. But the worry I have is when you do that for everything in your life, you're almost just outsourcing this process of learning or mastery to tools, and that will inevitably fail you in different ways. And this may or may not make sense. It does in my head, but I could tell you how to live a good life. And maybe I learned that over 70 years of my life experience. I could tell you, Ethan, let's imagine you're a 20-year-old. Hey, the key to a good life is to invest in relationships that matter to you. And that's it. That may not resonate with you at that time because you haven't had enough life experiences to learn that lesson. Maybe you didn't fail to invest in a relationship and then have that person die before you were able to do everything you wanted with them to really learn and solidify that wisdom for yourself. And so I worry about that with these tools as well, where people won't learn the hard lessons via doing the work to actually get to the point where they have that wisdom or mastery that actually makes them great at something.
Now you're speaking my language. The young kids these days, that's what we're talking about. I agree with you though, because if you extrapolate this far enough, you eventually start to come to some pretty like philosophical questions that maybe we don't have answers for, but there is a question here about like, what really is the purpose of being alive if so many parts of that experience are just extracted away or made simple, if you're protected from so many of them? And I think this is something, again, I think our generation has kind of a unique interaction with, because we were sort of the first one or the last ones out of the gate without all the technology immediately, and the first ones into the workplace with all of it. So yeah, I don't know. I tend to agree with you. I have another fear around this too. And I don't want to come across as sounding like overly negative, because I actually am very optimistic about this. Like I said, one thing that my mind has been changed on is that I really do think these tools are going to be able to carry out pretty much any task that a human could do. And I don't think that'll replace everyone, but it's going to open up like a lot of opportunity. So I'm generally optimistic about these and I'm fascinated by them. But I'm also very like fascinated by people and how people work. And there's some things that concern me in the way that people interact with these. For example, I think that what we currently have with AI is very impressive. If you know how it works, it's less impressive because you're like, oh, well, it's not really thinking. You know, it's basically guessing the next word in every sentence based on a billion or 100 billion past examples, right? So it doesn't really seem like intelligent if you understand what the model actually does. The problem is 99% of people will never understand what the model actually does. And like, yeah, actually 99.99999%. So what happens in a world where you have very impressive technology or very impressive looking technology that appears to be able to do something that it's not actually doing? And my concern is that we start to ascribe more skills to these tools than they actually have, which I think would be problematic, you know, like in terms of just being able to, here's a great example. I've seen people say already that they're using GPT-3 as a replacement for Google. And the problem with that is that while GPT-3 is capable of answering some questions correctly some of the time, it's not actually looking information up in most cases. I mean, there are some tools that have been built on top of it that are able to go to the web and actually pull information. But if you ask GPT-3, like, to prove why the earth is flat, it will do it and it will try and it will cite sources and it will create statistics that sound real, and that's its job. So when you have a large population of people who don't actually understand what the tool is doing in the background and start to use it for a purpose that is not really able to be used for, I have some concerns around what that's going to look like, I think. And that's it. That's all. Did I just do like an old man rant for like 5 minutes?
No, not at all. I wanted to see if Cal had anything to say, because I feel like I've been answering all the questions first. So Cal, any thoughts there?
Well, that reminds me a little bit. Me and Steph met this guy, Pete, in Thailand in 2017. And he had a phone, I think, or maybe he didn't have a phone, but he was very skeptical of technology because he had this one experience where he searched for a wallet online. And mind you, this guy had like 5 possessions. This was like a big deal for him to look for a wallet. And then after he searched for the wallet, he's like, they kept chasing me. Like, I kept seeing all these photos of the wallet, and it was basically just ads following him around. And he didn't understand that he had visited a website and his phone was cookied, and then advertisers were just kind of displaying ads to him. He thought that someone, like a physical person, was behind that, kind of tracking him around, showing him this wallet all the time. And it was an example of someone who didn't understand technology, and therefore he feared it and was skeptical of it in different ways. And so actually, I think one of the extensions of what you're saying, Ethan, is you already see examples of people who develop conspiracy theories and other things because they don't understand how the world or how technology works. And I think a lot of bad thinking is actually born out of this lack of fundamental understanding of, say, how Google works or how a Twitter algorithm works. And sometimes there can be, you know, assumed nefarious intent when it's really just an algorithm that is doing the job that it was programmed for.
I love that. My favorite example of this was it Dick Cheney? No. Who was the mayor of New York for a long time? And then under Trump, he was something else.
Rudy Giuliani.
Giuliani, I think. He tweeted something out, and he tweeted a tweet. It was a sentence. People can look this up. And he forgot the space between the period of the last sentence and the first word of the next sentence. And so it ended up turning it into a URL. So he tweeted like, you know, whatever. Don't talk to me about stamps. Like, it's not an issue. And then stamps.it just became a URL because he, you know, made an error in the way that he tweeted it. And somebody went and bought whatever that URL was immediately, and then loaded this whole anti-Trump thing onto the webpage. And Giuliani, in his lack of understanding of how that works, started claiming that he'd been hacked and all this crazy. There was a whole bunch of political turmoil that came from just a very simple typo and somebody understanding the opportunity versus maybe not understanding what had gone wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I think every new technology will bring some of these, I guess you could say intentional or not intentional, nefarious, not nefarious examples. They will happen. They absolutely will happen. And I think actually your example is a good one of people not realizing that GPT-3 is trained on all of the internet, and that includes the good stuff, the bad stuff. There is no content moderation the same way that you might see that elsewhere. And I'm not even saying I'm pro or against that content moderation, but yeah, I think it'll take some time. And honestly, there almost certainly will be regulation in this space. The thing about AI and regulation, though, is that AI is advancing so quickly. I don't know how regulation will keep up relative to other things we saw. Like, as an example, the social media space has been around. Like, Facebook was started in 2004, I believe. So it's been around for 18 years. And if you consider how long it took for any sort of regulation to come into play there, I think that's partially because a lot of these technologies are really misunderstood by the masses, and they're, I guess people underestimate them. And again, this exponential nature that we've talked about. And so I don't have the answers. There will need to be, I don't know, there will be things implemented, whether we like it or not, around these technologies, because there are risks. But that's also true with every technology. Like, another example of, you know, where things can go wrong is money, right? Money used to be physical. And then throughout the last couple of decades, it's transformed into a mostly digital asset. Well, at least before, you know, you couldn't have some, like, quote unquote, Kenyan king walk up to your door and say, "Hey, I'm a king. Like, you know, I want to give you money," and you wouldn't fall for that. But obviously, that is something that has come with the digital wave of payments and money and people getting tricked. And so, I mean, the more I learn about the arc of history and innovation's role in it, every innovation has a flip side to it. And I think maybe one way to frame it is it's literally a tool. And like every tool, whether it's fire, whether it's like a knife, you could say like knives are bad. They've killed a bunch of people, but like every household has a knife, right? And so I think technology is similar in that there's a good and a bad side, and we just have to figure out how to maximize the good and minimize the bad, which is a hard problem sometimes.
You're making me think of something that came up in your conversation with Karen Cheng?
Yep.
Which was so interesting to me. She was talking about the evolution of social, sort of like social, I keep wanting to say parameters because I spend way too much time behind
like the algorithm and what goes into it.
No. Like social norms, and to how she has this hope that, you know, that we'll evolve certain social norms related to the use of AI. Those could be potentially evolved quite a bit faster than legislation. And her hope, which I think was actually really smart, is that like collectively we'll come up with a set of social norms that help to keep this in check. And I thought it was really interesting the way you guys were talking about just the speed at which social norms can change. And I happen to agree. I think, you know, for better or worse, people are incredibly adaptable. And I one of the reasons I don't worry too much about this technology is because I still think fundamentally, like what it means to be a human in society, it's too important. Data, even though this could disrupt every part of day-to-day life, that would just be too disruptive. And so I think people will come up with their own weird little social hacks, social norms, social cues, so that this technology integrates into daily life. But I actually really don't think daily life 10, 15, 20 years from now is going to be that much different than it is now. I think we'll have fundamentally different tools for sure, but we will probably still wake up roughly the same way, sleep in beds, sit on chairs, like all that stuff is going to be largely the same. I know we're coming up on time here, and Cal, I know you got some travel coming up too. So I have one more question, but before I do, you guys have any like rebuttal to that? It looks like you got something you want to say there, Cal.
Well, I was just thinking about how certain social norms have changed. And I think one of my personal fears, and that's just because I value in-person human contact, maybe almost certainly more than the average like person who is born later than me, is around, let's say that AI develops fast enough where you actually have an AI girlfriend, and this is already happening. But what if 20% of the population has an AI girlfriend? And they do that because dealing with real humans is hard. They get angry, they have all these weird habits, and it's actually just more comfortable to talk to your AI girlfriend in a chat box, and who will eventually have I don't know, physical characteristics, if you use like AR or VR or something like that, and then all of a sudden you replace the human connection that you would have had going out in the real world with this AI girlfriend. And I think society is trending more and more towards that anyways. You can even think of dating apps as an early version of this, where we're filtering through all these people just based on their looks and a couple of answers to questions, instead of going out in the real world and having those in-person encounters and, I don't know, getting the pheromones of someone, which is actually an important part of connection. And so some people have a problem with that. They're like, oh no, like, remember the good old days when we used to talk to one another? And I think this AI technology in particular will just accelerate our siloedness and lack of connection with other people. And my concern around that is that connection with other people is a fundamental part of having a sense of well-being. And so even here today, we're connecting via remote technology with Zoom. I would much rather be in person with you, like having this experience, because I think there would be something gained from that. And so even though Zoom is efficient and we don't have to be in the same city, there's something lost with some of these things. And as that encompasses more and more of our life, I think you just see loneliness and the other kind of negative effects of that increase. And so I would be mindful of that if my whole life was just fully digitized. And so that's just, I would say, my main concern with all where all of this is heading, though I think it's going to happen either way.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. And I think, I mean, I definitely tend to skew more in that direction too. What has been sort of a sobering, or not sobering, but like the balancing force for me, I think Tim put it well on this podcast a couple of weeks ago. He likens a lot of these innovations to something like McDonald's, where, you know, yeah, it makes a certain form of interaction easier, cheaper, like, but it didn't get rid of restaurants. You know, in fact, it made a really nice experience in a restaurant more valuable, and in some ways, just led people to pursue that more. So the AI girlfriend thing is actually really interesting. I can't remember if this was while we were at Trends or Toptal, but somebody pointed me towards this group. This, like, wasn't there? I can't even remember Replica. The name of it now. Was it you? Was it you?
No, it was. So I think Sam found it. And just for the listeners, there's this tool called replica.ai, replica with a K, and it is a chatbot, an AI chatbot. And Cal, I think you actually played around with it, so you should share your experience with it. But there are a surprising number of people who have joined, I don't know if it's multiple Facebook groups or one, and they post in there. And perhaps the shocking part about it is, you might expect, oh, I'm playing with this for fun, like, it's enjoyable, but I understand its limitations, or the fact that it's a bunch of code on a screen. But that was not the impression that Sam got, and at least what he shared, which was people who, you know, would post in the group and would say, oh my gosh, like, my replica is being really mean to me today. I don't understand it. I've been so nice to it. And like, or just commenting on their replica as if it was a real person, and it was really impacting them, the responses that the replica was giving, the same way that you might be impacted with someone who's, you know, in a close relationship with you.
Yes. So that's the ones, and I guess it was Sam. I got obsessed with this when I first saw it. Not I've never used the app, but like the human side of what you're talking about there, like the Facebook groups, because that was going on. And at the time that I saw it come out, the company that ran Replica did something really interesting. They put the spicy talk behind a paywall. And so here's one of the interesting things that I think a lot of people don't think about. As soon, like, it was actually really sad, because, and I don't mean that in a way to make fun of people. It's very clear, if you hang out in these Facebook groups, some people lean on these Replica chatbots because they are in a really bad place socially. They're maybe in a relationship that they hate, or they feel totally isolated, or maybe they're geographically isolated. And so this is like, isn't a toy. It really comes to play a very important role in their life. And then all of a sudden the company paywalled like certain aspects of what the bot was able to do. And it had a very pronounced effect on people's like mental state, which I thought was so interesting. It's one of the reasons that I'm also hesitant of this technology, for some of the reasons that Cal's talked about, is because if you do, like, I'm going to use the word fool yourself. I'm going to say, if you fool yourself into believing that these are a real replacement for human connection or the ability to like remember facts or whatever, as soon as it goes away, and it can go away, it's a very different, it's like a, it can be a really dire situation for some people. So thank you for reminding me of the name there. Yes, there was a whole chapter there that was so interesting. And I think we're only going to see more of it, Cal. You're right, because it's only becoming better. Now, you know, like you said, Steph, AI can create people's, like you, your replica can have a whole look. It can look like it's talking to you. Like there's all these things that are, they're designed to short circuit the human brain at a level that we've never experienced before. So it's definitely going to be a tricky time, I think. But, yeah. Oh, sorry, can I add just one more thing there? Related to what you said, Cal, too, about us doing this digitally versus in person, part of me wonders, does society go the opposite direction? Because I think the novelty of knowing that you're talking to a computer wears off pretty quickly. And once it becomes, like, there's a scenario 2 years from now where I'm not even sure you're on this call anymore, right? Because you could just have your AI step in and with some pretty simple language models, it could answer most of my simple questions, right? So at what point do I just stop doing Zoom calls? Because I'm like, well, I don't even know if I'm talking to Cal or not. You know, we could go the opposite direction.
Can I just quickly note that I think will be a reality at some point, and people, you know, at least while we were growing up, always thought of cloning as like the physical clone. Like if I could grow myself in a petri dish and then like have like 10 Stephs walking around. But I actually think the digital version of that will exist, as you're saying, like you're cloning yourself, your brain, your capacity for knowledge and doing things in the digital world. It doesn't exist quite yet, but you know, you can see the line to that future.
You just blew my mind. Okay, Cal, you've been sitting here wanting to say something about this. So what do you got?
No, just to give something to the positive side of something like Replica, you could see a world in which someone was immensely depressed or isolated. And this actually becomes a tool for them to have some sort of social interaction that gets them over to the hump to be, say, more emotionally regulated. And then they can reintegrate into the world of meaning in which they operate in. But at the same time, I think people are going to take this too far. And if you grow up natively just interacting with Replica because it's nicer in middle school than the fellow humans that you meet, you just see a world in which you become further and further apart. And I think this is all related to why you might see more polarization in the world or more loneliness. It's all about, you know, kind of forgetting that we're all having this shared experience and that most people are good, and learning how to have these like small points of connection that remind you of that. Technology allows you to bypass that and bypass some of the hard moments, but at the same time, it takes you away from learning these skills and these lessons. And I think it's easier to say, look at and other people in this us versus them dynamic because of these things. And so I think they can be used as tools, but naturally there'll be these costs for people who go too far down that line of thinking.
Can I just give one example of where a technology which we're all familiar with can be really detrimental or a positive thing, like the same technology, which is games, right? Like gaming is something where people, like there are children who are addicted to games. And where do you draw the line at addiction? It's really hard to say because, you know, well, gaming now is also a sport, like a career, right? So there's esports. So you could say, oh, actually it's like a really lucrative thing. But then there are cases where kids dissociate so much from the wider world around them, it is taking away from other parts of their life. And so again, that line of where you draw, like, is gaming fun and something that actually connects kids to other kids, albeit digitally? Is it an addiction? Is it something that now is actually a job? Is it something where they're learning skills? All of those can kind of be true depending on the kid, depending on the situation. And I think for a long time, people actually saw gaming as mostly negative. And I think that is shifting at least a little bit. And to use a parallel, like if a kid had a bunch of like a really strong community around them, and all of a sudden they just like went into gaming and they were really dissociated and all by themselves and became really depressed, I think that maybe you could frame as like a negative development. But in many of these cases, it's like these kids like didn't really have an outlet. They didn't really know how to interact with others around them. And instead they've replaced them with, again, they're digital, but like friends they connect with, like they're in a different kind of community that maybe some people don't understand, but they've found their own unique community that they love, right? And I think it's natural, again, for many people to judge that something happening in the digital world, whether it's connections or community or a sense of belonging, is inherently worse than those exact same things in the physical world. And I think that judgment is partially because of some of the things we talked about, like our place in history. But I don't think that will be seen the same way in you know, even 20, 30 years. I think it'll be a very normal thing for some people, not all people, but for some people to have most of their life, their connections, their relationships, etc., just purely online. So we'll see. We'll see how, you know, I'm happy to be proven wrong. I will just say a caveat to my own point. I think you guys are both right that naturally, as much more of our lives go online, there is a yearning for in-person connection. And so I think you almost see like a barbelled situation for many of us where it's like, I want to do all my work online, but then I've wanted to be around people more than ever in other parts of my life. So we'll see.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's super. I'm so glad we got to have some time to sit down and do this. And Cal, since you threw it out there, I will say we definitely have to get together in person soon. But yeah, I think both of you are such fascinating thinkers on this. So thanks for coming on and taking some time to chat about it. I did have one last question, which is just like, we touched on it earlier, but you know, how are you thinking about the next, say, 2 to 3 years of your career in light of all this stuff? Is there anything that you're changing now in order to accommodate whatever you think the next few years is going to bring?
I'm just learning. I'm trying not to speculate too much. I think I even tweeted the other day, like my only prediction around AI is really that I don't have predictions because it's just wowed me so many times. But I think I'm just trying to stay up to date and play around with the tools. And I think that's also partially because I think it gives me some grounding, because if I just hear a bunch of people talking about these tools and like seeing the outputs of it, I don't really have a sense of what's being built. And I think even getting into some of the tools and like trying to create my own images, I understand the nuances. I understand the level of skill you need in prompting or prompt engineering. And it also helps me think about, you know, what's to come in a way. I know I said I have no predictions, but it helps ground me a little bit and feel like I truly understand what's going on. And then, I mean, I feel like AI has been maybe the industry or like the set of tools that have come out recently have been the most like, oh my gosh, for me. And so as part of that, I'm like very, very keen to stay at the edge of that, because I think, you know, so many companies are going to come out of this. I don't know exactly like what I'm going to build in the space, but there is also like an interest in building as well.
So my main focus with the AI tools is just improving what I'm currently doing, or seeing if those tools can help me with that. So if I can write articles or a book in a faster or better way, or a more collaborative way, because writing is kind of lonely. So you can imagine an AI tool can become like a true collaborator or like an editor, and then I won't have to, you know, hire someone and wait for them to respond and all those things. And so I'm seeing if those tools are viable in that way. And then on the side, like Steph, I'm just playing around, because similar to crypto, which now has a pretty tainted reputation, my approach to things like DeFi or NFTs or all the different blockchain technologies that came out was just to go and tinker around, see if there's something there that would be useful to me. And part of that is just I'm a little bit of a dilettante in my career. And so playing around with the new technologies, like there might be something that sticks. Maybe there's an affiliate business that I build off of the new AI tools, or maybe I experiment with like a newsletter that I wouldn't otherwise have time to write that is mostly written by AI, and see if I can make something out of that. And so it's more, how can I action this in my life versus try to keep up with the latest things? And it might be a nothing burger, or I don't know, maybe 5 years from now, it'll be something really special.
Or like crypto. 5 years from now, it could be really special. And then 6 years from now, it could go from billions to zero overnight. I don't know. We'll see. This was, it's crazy, guys. I have not felt this way probably ever in my career as it comes to, as it relates to technology, like something that's truly that interesting and has that much potential. And we've seen a lot come and go. I want to thank you both for coming on here. I'm going to shout out your links in just a second, but before I do, I wanted to end with one quote. So I work with an illustrator over at Trends, Kelsey Tyler. She's incredible. We've had a lot of really interesting conversations about like what this actually means for creative people. And she was saying that there is this paper, it's called The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. It was written back in the 60s, or actually wait, no, the 30s, back when like mechanic, like paintings were just first starting to be replicated mechanically. And what does that mean for the value of like human made art? And so I've just started reading it. But there's a quote in here that I like a lot, and I just wanted to kind of get on the record for other people who are listening to this. So here it goes. It goes, "Our fine arts were developed, their types and uses were established in times very different from the present by men whose power of action upon things was insignificant in comparison with our own. But the amazing growth of our techniques, the adaptability and precision they've attained, the ideas and habits they are creating, make it a certainty that profound changes are impending in the ancient craft of the beautiful." And I just love that line, the ancient craft of the beautiful, because I think that's, at the end of the day, that is like what we're focused on as humans, that it's always been the domain of like human work in some form or another has been this craft of the beautiful. And now we're seeing once again disruption that's going to lead to more of that. So I enjoyed this conversation a lot. I want to thank you guys for coming on. For everybody listening, be sure to check these two out. We have the Shit You Don't Learn in School podcast, right? Which is, what's the best place for people to find that besides just Googling it? It's a very Googleable name.
Well, you can find it at listenandlearn.co, but just a quick funny story on that. One of my coworkers the other day was like, "Oh, you have that podcast." And most of the time people get the name wrong. They say like the shit they don't teach you in school or something like that. And he was like, "The shit your dad never told you," or something. I was like, okay. Not quite, but you know, yeah, close enough.
Maybe go check out listenandlearn.co. And then, of course, Steph is hosting A16Z's new podcast, so be sure to check them out. Like I said, Steph, great job with that. I loved the episode with Karen. Steph is at StephSmithIO on Twitter. And Calvin, I was just pulling up yours. What's your Twitter handle? Can you hit me with that real quick?
Calvin_Rosser.
Calvin_Rosser on Twitter. All right, guys, this was a blast. We'll have to do it in person again soon. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ethan.
Thanks for having us.